Set number 26813, June Darton, Reel 1.
June Darton, Reel 1. Can we begin by just talking a little bit about your life before the war? And can you tell me when and where you were born, please?
I was born in Penarth, South Wales. And when, you want to
and
know
when,
this?
Sort
of. The 8th of June, 1924.
And can you tell me your family circumstances at that point?
Yes, my father was an architect in Cardiff, and my mother had come from a family in Wiltshire where her father had a cloth mill, a woolen mill. He started West of England Cloth. And so we were living in South Wales.
And did you have any brothers and sisters?
No, sadly.
And were you? Did you go to school in that?
I went to my first school. I went to a little school called St Alma's in Penarth until I was about 8.
And after that?
Well, after that, my parents got divorced, and I was sent off to boarding school to Courtfield House in Bognor Regis. I was nearly 9. And it was all rather intimidating because I'd been on my own living all that way, you know. And I stayed there till just before my 16th birthday, which was in the middle of the war. And everyone was rather expecting an invasion of the south coast of England by the Germans. And my parents at that time, my mother had remarried when I was about 10. And I was not allowed to know my stepfather because divorce was such a disgrace in those days. And she suddenly whisked off to India with this man. And I wasn't allowed to meet him. And they were out there for 5 years before I even met them. Even they came home once on leave and with this strange man. And I'd seen a picture of him playing polo in India and with some other chaps. And I chose the best looking one, saying it was my stepfather, and when he came off the train, it wasn't the same one at all. But anyway, they were home on leave. They went up to Scotland. They didn't like to think of me sitting on the south coast waiting to be invaded, so to speak. But the sad thing was that I was really at home at that school because I had no other home. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, who was a widow and lived in a London hotel, she was my guardian, and a very, very marvellous person who wrote to me twice a week. Always, because she was on her own then. And I don't know what I've got to say. Stop it. I don't know what I've got. That's very stupid.
How did you end up in Scotland?
Well, after 5 years, my mother and my stepfather came back from India. They were posted up to Scotland, to Elgin, and they didn't like the thought of me sitting on the south coast with the Germans across the Channel. And so in the middle of school year, just before my birthday, I was sent up to Scotland to join them, where I had a very short time at a very grim little commercial school. I didn't understand a word anybody said. I was trying to learn shorthand and typing. But that didn't last too long, because then my stepfather one night, they were in a little billet in Elgin. There was a sort of dispatch rider banging on the door in the pouring rain late at night, and with orders that my stepfather should leave next morning. He didn't say where for the war. And so we just stayed up there a short while longer and then came down to London, where I started at Queen's Secretarial College, where I did a 9 month course. But after a few months, in summer, there was bombing in London. We were at Englefield Green and we could see, they were bombing London, we could see the whole of London, the sky being absolutely scarlet, and we were all made to sleep on the floor in the dining room because they didn't think it was safe, the house would fall on our heads. Because we'd been in Queensgate, we were evacuated to Clarence Lodge. And then I started looking for a job when I qualified, and we had a rather splendid woman called Mrs. Simmons, who was the principal of the college, and they gave one a list of possible things to do, and the first one was the rank organisation. I thought that sounded rather exciting at that age of mine, and I went along to just beside the Dorchester for an interview, and to my great chagrin, they didn't want me. I couldn't believe it. And then someone said, look, there is a war on. Why didn't you do something useful? So I went along to Baker Street, to the International ISRB, 64 Baker Street, and joined up there, and was put in the finance section, which was terribly dull. But I worked for John Howard, who was number one to Wing Commander Venner, who was the head of all the finances, and I understand did very, very, very well for SOE, who were the finances.
What do you recall about those two men, Howard and Venner?
Well, John Howard had a wall eye, so he was a flight lieutenant. So I suppose he hadn't been, I mean, you were very much Miss Stanley, you weren't June or anything like that. You were all very formal. And one didn't really know very much about him. He was sort of not very emotional, rather cool and a very fair boss, but not easy to sort of get terribly close to. And Wing Commander Venner was terrifying. I mean, he just used to march in and say, give me that file, and you didn't know what it was because you'd never heard of Skefco ball bearings. The very first day I was there, he said, come and get that file. And I just fiddled around with the papers and didn't find it, needless to say. Anyway, that sort of sorted itself out. Anyway, then I was with him every 6 months I used to go to the personnel section and say, please, can I go somewhere more interesting? Because at that time I was living in the old Queensgate building. We had about eight of us were living at the top, and one of them was in SOE with me, and we used to sort of whisper in the bathroom what she was doing, which was very exciting.
Can you remember what she was doing?
Yes, she was in the travel section working with Catriona Sopper. And she was called Barbara Sampson in those days. And the joke was that she had a very witty mind, and she told me that, you know, it was rather saw these delicious young men around, but how'd you get to know them? All she had to do was take them from her office to the boss's office and back in. So she had this lovely saying. She used to say, which end of the bath do you sit? As a sort of opening gambit, hoping something would happen between the two. Anyway, I struggled on every time I went 6 months to change my job, they wouldn't let me, because John Howard didn't want me to go.
And what were your duties in?
Well, I was just his secretary. I was of no interest to anyone, really. I just worked for him, you know. One of his remits was all the properties, all the houses all over England, so one knew where all the training places were and everything like that. So that was part of our job quite a lot. And then expenses for agents and expenses. And James, my husband, used to come in for expenses for his funny Russians he was with. But we didn't meet for years until afterwards when we were in Italy. And anyway, then I moved eventually after a couple of years and joined the Swedish section, which again wasn't very interesting. But Henry Threlfall was working there with a man called Whiskyman. And then Henry moved. He'd just been sent out of Sweden as persona non grata for what he was doing in the Swedish embassy over there. And, I mean, he was a fluent German speaker. Anyway, then he was appointed to go out to Italy and run the Polish section out there and asked me to join him.
How much, again, were you, when you were working for the Swedish section, how aware were you of, say, operations and the agents? Did you see anything of the agents themselves?
Nothing at all. No, the Swedish section was short and sharp, and I was only there a couple of months. I wasn't involved with that at all. But Henry had come back, was rather proud of himself having been thrown out of Sweden. No, I really didn't pick up very much of interest in that I could tell you that's worthwhile at all.
Again, what was Henry Threlfall like?
I can tell you exactly what he was like. He looked like a German officer. He was absolutely upright, rather clipped, and people used to call him Henry Dreadful. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah.
Now, I was very fond of Henry. We all got to know him in the end very well, but he did have a German background, and we all thought he really was German. I think he was, really. And one reason I thought for many years later was that we went to a wonderful special forces evening at the Mansion House, and this was a long time later, and I'd worked for Colin Gubbins while I after the war. And anyway, Henry sat next to me. We had a party of about 10 in the Mansion House, and they started playing the Eton Boating song, and he didn't know what it was, which I thought was strange. I thought I put my finger on it. Anyway, no, he became a good friend in the end, but he was very, not easy, again, not easy to get alongside while we were all on duty. And then he married a rather glamorous Hungarian whom he met on the train going through. There were lots of chats about that. And then they moved at the end. He then joined Unilever, where he was there for years. And I used to sometimes be asked to do his little dissertations about what he'd done for the Unilever magazine. So, you know, that used to go in the magazine. But they came back and they bought a beautiful house at Stranton-on-the-Green called the Dutch House. And we were living in Chelsea, so we saw a lot of them there.
When you were still in Baker Street before you moved on to Italy, how aware were you of other sections and what other people, other sections were doing?
Oh, one was very aware.
Quite tight, or was...
Actually, it's not quite true. We knew the names of everybody. I mean, they all had their symbols and their names. And one knew the heads of the sections and everything, but security was pretty close. It was close. I mean, any details we didn't really know, but you know, there was the French and the Free French, and no, we didn't really know what went on.
And the premises themselves, it was on 64 Baker Street.
Yeah, 64 Baker Street, old Marks and Sparks building. Then next door, Norgeby House, was the extension of Marks and Sparks.
What was it like inside?
Oh, it's rather grim. We went into a sort of narrow, dark passage, and I went up to the first floor. It was very dreary, frightfully dreary. But, you know, there we were, couldn't argue. And, of course, the first day in the office, I'd never been in an office in my life, and I thought at 4:30 it was time to go home. Of course it wasn't. But the worst thing was, you know, one had had various typing, and then you'd chuck it in the wastepaper basket. And, of course, we weren't allowed to do that. They'd all had to be very carefully sort of... Well, not, we didn't tear it up, but just, you just didn't leave it in the wastepaper basket. So it was all a big learning curve.
Was there a canteen and things like that inside as well?
No. And the men used to go to a lovely pub around the corner called the Swinger, but of course in those days girls never went into pubs. I mean, if you had a boyfriend he might take you, but certainly not on your own. So we tried out all the places all the way around, and if we had a bit of money one day we'd go to Richoux, which was good. Otherwise, we were eating some grotty sandwich somewhere. We didn't mind. It was all part and parcel of the thing.
And socially, outside, did you sort of spend time with people who worked as well for SOE? Or
only the odd girlfriend.
But there was no... I mean, did you, no, you advise not to do that? Or
no, it was just the way the cookie crumbled. I mean, you know, I hadn't met anyone to go out with much. So, you know, and my grandmother lived in London. Lived in Queensgate and various places around.
And what was London like for those that period of 2 years, I suppose, or a year or so?
Oh, yes. Well, no, it was definitely... Yes, it was 2 years. It was all rather dreary and dull. I mean, nothing was going on. There was no sort of life. Well, I mean, obviously, lots of young people had a good social time, had a good time, but we just got on with it. I mean, it was nothing exciting happening. Really.
So then there's opportunity to move abroad.
Yeah, I was then. That was marvellous. All I could wait. I couldn't wait to get there. And so I went off to Italy, because Monopoly, they were down on the where we were. Henry was working, and the headquarters over that side were on the eastern shore, south of Bari.
And by that time you'd moved into the Fannies, hadn't you?
We had to become Fannies to be able to leave England. We had to have a uniform. So we went up to Buckinghamshire to a house and have 10 days training to try and be a fanny. And the joke was, of course, there was no electricity in that house. And we had to learn, you know, to trim the lamps and things like that. And sweep the floors and lie on horrible wooden mattresses. And it was only 10 days, really, but it seemed a very long time.
Can you remember much about the training itself, the sort of things that you were supposed to be doing?
We weren't trained. We were just turned into to look like fannies. And we never... I wish I'd learnt to drive a motor car or know the inside of one or that sort of thing. No. No, we were purely there to have a bit of discipline thrown into us and know how to sort of march up and down a bit. and then come down to London and report to the it was Nelson Falls Notes Bridge. There was a barracks there, and you had to sort of go and get your pay and know how to salute. That's what all they taught us.
And your uniforms, were these made up especially? Did you have to get them from anywhere in particular?
Awful thought. Yes, so they were all identical. Yes, we must have gotten, and it's funny, one's memory doesn't go. We must have got from somewhere, because we were all very envious, because all the slightly older people now went to Cairo and they had lovely cream shirts, and we had horrible little khaki ones and things. So we had to have this sort of regular issue. I can't remember where it was issued from, but that's what it was. And they only put us in uniform to send us abroad. People like myself. Because then you were under sort of discipline, I suppose.
And you sailed out from...
From Liverpool, yes. That was the moment.
Yes, we talked about this.
Yes. Do you want to hear that?
Yes, please.
Well, very exciting. The day came when I was told we'd go to Italy. And I was the lowest form of officer life, being an ensign. And I had two other Fennies with me, who were my draft of two. And we got on this night train from St Pancras or something like that. It can't be St Pancras anyway. And we went to Liverpool, and we didn't know it was Liverpool. And you couldn't see, everything was blacked out. You couldn't see anything. You didn't know anything. And on the way, we wanted to sew Polish eagles on our uniforms, which we thought were terribly smart. We weren't allowed to keep them later. But anyway, in the train, I remember saying one. We weren't allowed them in London. I thought, my God, we'll wear them now. Anyway, when we got to Liverpool, as it happened to be, stationed in the night, all the troops on the troop ship were lined up. They were all lined up in the station. And I said to my drafter two, oh, there's a ship. There's a ship. Let's get on board. I mean, that's obviously everyone was going up. All the soldiers were going up one gangplank. We went up the other. And... I'd never been abroad in my life. I'd never been on a ship in my life. And we started, I said, let's have a look around. So we started walking around the deck, and suddenly, to our horror, we heard the very angry voice over the tannoy calling us to the adjutant's office by name to report there immediately. So we found the adjutant's office. And when we got in there, it was absolutely irate. Adjutant with a very pale young, I suppose, security officer standing beside him, who was given absolute hell for letting us just wandering onto that ship in the middle of a war, because we should have gone through his hands, and there's this little sort of porter cabin on the edge of the thing. We didn't even see it, because of course we shouldn't have gone aboard with any photographs, any letters or anything incriminating, you know, that the enemy could pick up for wartime. And they said, oh, you probably won't be able to go on the ship now. Actually, I'd seen my trunk go down the hold. I was a bit upset. Anyway, they let us go back. And then we sailed in convoy out into the middle of the Atlantic somewhere. We didn't know where we were going. We went, actually, I remember very well, because we went past Southern Ireland, and various people were saying, you know, that all the Germans were in Southern Ireland. They could watch all these troop movements and everything going on. You know, it really was rather grim. And then eventually we came through the Straits of Gibraltar. And to the excitement, the lights were on in North Africa. Do you want to hear the story?
Yeah, well, yes.
Sorry.
June Darton, Reel 2. Can you tell me about the accommodation on the boat and what it was like, the journey from Liverpool down to Egypt?
No, to Naples.
To Naples.
Anyway, we've finally been allowed back on the ship. We were told where our cabins were. And it was the old Windsor Castle that used to do the trip from South Africa to England. Everyone used to come on those Windsor Castle, on those boats, the castle line. And so we went down to this, we were pointed out where we were, and it was a little corridor with about four little cabins each side with a curtain, and each one had two berths in them. And I saw that my friends, my draft, they had a cabin opposite mine. And then I walked into the cabin, pulled the curtain aside where I was going to be. And to my horror, there must have been about 10 women in there. And I just said, I can't, I can't. can't come in. I can't live through this. And then suddenly a nice voice from the far end of the cabin it wasn't big, but suddenly she reared up, a nice ATS, red-headed ATS sergeant. She said, "Don't worry, you and I are sharing this cabin. I'm just giving a pep talk to my draft." And they were all cooks. They were all sort of round and came from north of England, a lot of them, I think. And, of course, they were as young as we all were, and they'd never been abroad. So she was just giving them a little sort of pep talk. She said, "Don't worry." And then they all faded away to their little cabins of two down thing. And so away we went, and I had a delightful companion in my cabin. And, I mean, you know, there was the odd concert that went on. Then it went out into the Atlantic. We weren't aware of who was around. I mean, we couldn't see we didn't really realise we were in a great convoy. I wasn't aware of it at all. I was just trying to get used to being on a ship. It was very exciting, lovely. I can remember sort of standing in the bows on some days, you know, in the sun and the sea pounding over it. It was too lovely. Anyway, then we turned through the Straits of Gibraltar. I wasn't aware of that. But I did know that if we got near the African shore, there'd be lights. And after all, we'd been in a blackout in England, and I hadn't seen lights for ages. So I asked one of these nice chaps that I'd met, would he let me go up on deck? Because, of course, none of the women were allowed on deck. The only other women, there can't have been more than 20 of us on that ship. And so he said, "Okay, but you're not allowed on deck, so you better wear my greatcoat and my cap. And if we meet at a certain point, we could just have a brief trot round the deck, you know, and you could see." So up we went, and I put on his greatcoat and his cap and started walking with him. Well, foolishly, he was rather attractive, so I just sort of put my arm through his, linked my arm with his as we walked around, and he nearly died. Said, "Get down once, go." Because I now realise it wasn't exactly what should happen between two officers walking around the tent. Anyway, that was that. They had a concert on board one night, and we had to play funny roles. I was no good at things like that. But and then we eventually landed in Naples.
And did you stay together, the three of you?
Yes, we stayed together. And all the other people on the ship went up to the Anso beachhead, and, you know, that really was breaking our hearts, because the very thought of them going up with the thought of, we might, you know, we never did see them again, but, you know, that they could get killed, it was absolutely terrible. And then we were picked up by in a little PU pickup car and driven over to Monopoly, where we were stationed.
Was Naples and the countryside around it, were they damaged at all? Were you suddenly quite aware of being...
No, it wasn't. No, because they weren't fighting around there, I didn't think. Anyway, we didn't see any damage. We went just straight into the middle of Naples just for a night and then shot off across. And we didn't see anything because it was the sort of southern part of the country. And then I landed in this little, funny little town of Monopoly.
And can you describe it? There's a harbour there, isn't there?
There's a harbour there, a small harbour there, and it's mainly it's got the town square with, you know, I think it had palm trees in. I got a picture of it anyway. And we were in a fanny mess, in quite a nice house. But the WT people were all at a different part of thing, and we never knew them. We were all doing, you know, I never knew any of those WT people. We met them later on. And we used to then have the offices. The officer's mess was at the top of a little wide road where we were, very simple houses and things. And James, my husband, was in the officer's mess higher than we were. But it was quite funny, I heard later, that he was never good at getting up in the mornings. And Henry Threlfall was sharing the billet with him. And so he used to go around and bang the bottom of James's bed with his stick or to try and wake him up. And then Henry would come across to my office, and James was in a different one with Peter Wilkinson. And then we'd all foregather up at the in the officer's mess, you know, for sort of not coffee, tea and bread and things like that. We had a wonderful little Pole in my section called Trushkovsky. I'm sure he'll be on record there. He was a delight, and he'd been a professor. who was a professor in New Zealand, went back and became a professor in New Zealand after the war. But he had wonderful humour. I really liked him. It was fun.
Can you remember what he was doing?
He was right in the middle of all these Polish operations we were doing. You know? And he was, of course, being a Pole himself. But he was just different.
What were your duties during this period when you were working for the Polish section?
Well, I was nothing of any consequence. I mean, I was just did all the office work for George Clouther, who was there, and Henry. And, you know, they were setting up these operations and all the horrors, because they had these group of British officers that were due to be dropped into Poland. And they were up in little Trulli houses and up in houses in the hills. And they used to come down through the office and collect their mail and things like that. And more disgruntled as they couldn't get away, you know, they were having a very grim time. And then gradually they did get away, but none of it was a success. Of course, the Polish uprising became a disaster. We were doing everything we could to send supplies and agents up there, and flying all that way from... The airfield was down at Brindisi, and flying all the way across Europe like that in the middle of a war, dropping agents, dropping guns and things. And then, of course, the terrible thing was that the Russians were our allies, called allies. And the signal came for the Warsaw Uprising, and the Russians did they stopped about 12 miles short of Warsaw and let them all be slaughtered. And it was something so desperate, so desperate. And that was, you know, one of the tragedies of the war.
And did you see much of the Polish agents as well, who were due to parachute into Poland?
Yes, we used to see them, because they were up in these little Trulli houses in the hills, run by another group of fannies, the ones that could cook and looked after them, you know. And we'd be asked out for weekends for parties and, you know, just to chat with them. And although they didn't speak much English, and certainly spoke no Polish. But they were such fun, and they had this great sort of thing. They had a big blanket, and they'd hold four corners of it and hurl you up in the air. And it was all rather entertaining. They were so joyous, the Poles. I've always had a great affection for them, and they sang and did things like that. But our commanding officer was Mary McVane, who was Colin Gubbin's cousin. And she was wonderful, and really the right person, being a true Scot, to be with them up there. And I remember New Year's Eve, we all went up, and she did something you do in Scotland, I think, which was a great bowl of boiling water or something. She poured wax in, and she told your future, all that sort of thing. And there was a very nice atmosphere up there. And then I'd heard from other people, they had this bar up there, and they had ropes coming down from the ceiling. And so if any of the men, and we didn't get near the bar, thank God, the minute they drank too much, they just strung them up with these ropes. That was a good sort of Polish custom, I suppose. But that was that.
And as things became more desperate that summer, mm. with the rising, mm. were you aware of the disasters that were mm. overtaking the Poles, or was it just a sense of desperation?
No, we didn't know that. We didn't know about the Russians not doing anything. But we knew that, things were desperate for the Poles. And then at the end of the war, Henry flew up on a mission to the general, I can't remember his name, it wasn't Kesselring, but it was a German general, a sort of peace, in Slovakia, I think they went. And he flew up there, and there was a sort of meeting, surrender and sort of things like that. And he came home, came back absolutely thrilled to bits with, champagne and God knows what, all sorts of things like that for the officers down where we were. We didn't see any of that, but he was very pleased, you can imagine, because he was absolute fluent German speaker, and so he was just the person to be chosen.
Other officers that you mentioned, Peter Wilkinson.
Yes.
Is it George Clouther?
George Clouther was Polish, and he was Henry's number one.
Yes, I was going to ask us what you remember of those officers themselves. Did you see much of them?
Yes, George was working in the same. Now, I didn't see so much of Peter Wilkinson, James was working with Peter.